Stay tuned for Bob and Yurt Live, but first, here's our Denver Bible Church update with an excerpt from this week's sermon.
An English proverb states that one father is more than 100 schoolmasters. Our society, though, commonly diminishes the role of fathers. It's so cliche to point out that on primetime sitcoms, the father is the fool. He's out of date. He's out of step. But they make a sitcom. They want it to air for multiple seasons. And so they also make him lovable. But he's the lovable fool. That's Hollywood's most common portrayal of dads in prime time. And even in commercials where the mother is the strength, the decision maker. I'm even tempted to say, well, really, that's true. But in our culture, it so permeates us to demean the father, and it's just everywhere. Dad could be a comic prop in a commercial, but it wasn't always that way. Think of the first TV shows that had family settings where the dad was respected by the wife, looked up to, the children honored their father. And that was a role model for families that were broken to say, you know, we could be like that. We could love one another and respect one another. But instead, of course, Hollywood has done a complete 180 and is at the head of the slide into the destruction of the family. If you do an assessment of Disney movies, of their major films, dozens of them, they have the main characters being young kids, children. They might be young mice or something, or bugs, but they're often young. And the main child characters in their movies almost always have no fathers, non-existent father influences. And we know that when we look at Disney, you know, under Michael Eisner and their Miramax label, Disney produces many films that are destructive to young people and families, sexually immoral, movies promoting homosexuality, and they even have produced entertainment for kids, for young children, that includes drunkenness, sexuality, even nudity. And I'm thinking of one kids' movie called Baby, about a baby dinosaur, that's just so despicable. But when they leave out fathers in their movies, of course, it could be partly because they don't value traditional morality and family. On the other hand, there's a cinematic reason why Disney movies omit fathers. There's actually a pretty good reason why they'd have to, because it's the father's role to protect his children. And Disney's movies, the ones that are made for kids, they try to identify with a young audience. And a movie needs a compelling plot to draw the audience in. And so the writers of the script of the movie, they need to get their main character, this little kid or a little dog or cat or a little mouse or a little human child, they need to get him into trouble somehow, into real trouble. And so the easiest way to develop a plot to get a kid into trouble is to have no dad around.
This is Pastor Bob Enyart of Denver Bible Church inviting you to visit us at denverbiblechurch.com or in person this Sunday at 6200 West Hampton near Hampton and Wadsworth. So come on out Sunday morning, Sunday night. We'd love to see you, love to meet you. Call us for directions at 303-463-1707. That's 303-463-1707. Now stay tuned for Bob and Yart Live.
One warning is truth of a hate.
brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Benyard, America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic anti-choice talk show host. Our phone number, 1-800-8-ENYARD, 1-800-836-9278. What a battle royale going on the internet at theologyonline.com. In fact, here's the latest post in the battle by the moderator, the administrator. Ding, ding, ding. That's it for round one. What a start. Zakath is now on the clock as round two has begun. All right. And there's a grandstand where people, the debate is just between two people. I am debating the issue of does God exist, that question, with an atheist whose username online is Zakath. And he presented a post, which we talked about last night, and in it he pretty much just put out two questions. How do you define God, and upon what evidence do you base your belief in what you defined as God? So I have a rather lengthy reply. It's probably, if you print it out, 12-point font, probably three full pages. But I'd like to relate my reply to you from Theology Online. This is a 10-round debate. And on a forum on the internet, typically anybody could post on a forum. But this forum, these battle royales, this is the seventh one at Theology Online. And this one is only the two debate opponents are allowed to post. So you can check it out, you can read, and you could go to the grandstands and post there your comments, which are fascinating. There's already over 250 comments posted in the grandstands, and the debate is only one round in. So it's going to be fun, but here we go. Let me read to you, and then I'll summarize parts of the post. I start out, thank you, Knight. The administrator's username is Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. Thank you, Knight, for hosting this battle. And Zakath, thank you for agreeing to debate this most important of topics for human beings. For billions of people have directed their lives by a belief in a God of some kind. And if no God exists, then there is an incalculable opportunity cost of wasted human effort. Imagine all the energy, thinking, writing, praying, worship, all wasted if there's no God. All the time spent seeking God's will, reading about him, talking about him, evangelizing. Wow, if there's no God, what a waste of human effort. For all the time spent chasing that lie, humanity could have been more effectively pursuing the truth. While I will directly address your questions in this post, I must first ask you something that takes precedence over your questions. Therefore, my first question for you is, does truth exist? If you say that nothing can be true, then you would have admitted your belief that nothing you write is true, and you would have thereby divulged your belief that you could not win the debate with any truthful arguments. Thus, if you claim that truth does not exist, that nothing can be true, then if you actually believe that claim to be true, which itself shows the inanity of holding that position, then you should immediately forfeit the debate. If you deny the existence of truth, I would note yet another educated person whose atheism has undermined his very ability to accept truth. I hope that you acknowledge the existence of truth. So that's the first part of my post. The first paragraph, the introduction, and my first question, which I state it takes precedence over his questions. He asked, how do you define God, and what is your evidence for God? And if someone denies that truth exists, then even if you define God, just the words you use have no meaning. And so you have to find out if someone believes in truth. I learned this lesson a long time ago, years ago, debating liberals about abortion being wrong. And you go round and round, and they refuse to admit, they refuse to see the reason in your arguments, and they refuse to admit that abortion is wrong. So then you explore a little bit their worldview, their belief system, and you find out they don't believe anything is wrong. They don't believe murder is wrong, rape is wrong. The Nazis killing the Jews, they didn't believe that was wrong. They say there's no such thing as right and wrong. Wouldn't it have been nice and honest of them at the outset to say, well, I don't believe anything is wrong? So it's usually good to build a foundation for your discussion and find out, well, do you believe in truth? Could something be true or false? And then, do you believe in right and wrong? Okay, so let's continue with my post. Zakath's questions, that's the heading now, Zakath's questions. Here are my brief answers to your two questions, which I will develop further. Question one, how do you define God? Answer one, I define God as the supernatural creator of the natural universe, existing eternally, powerful, wise and knowledgeable, personal, loving, and just. So that's how I defined God. You know, the more you know about someone, the more you can use to describe that person. And so I didn't go into specific biblical details about God as far as the Trinity, the Incarnation, and the resurrection of Jesus Christ. I didn't go into any of those things. But how do you define God? I define God as the supernatural creator of the natural universe, existing eternally, powerful, wise, and knowledgeable, personal, loving, and just. Question two, upon what evidence do you base your belief in God? Answer two, in this post, I present evidence only related to the creative, eternal, powerful, and knowledgeable aspects of God, from the origins of both the universe and biological life. Right? So you get, I'm saying in my answer, I'm not trying in this post to prove that there's a loving God. I'm trying to prove that there is a creator, an eternal, powerful, and knowledgeable creator. And I'm taking my evidence from the origins of both the universe and biological life. And so we'll come back from the break and we'll get into the meat of this. It's fun. Listener-supported radio right here, Bob Benyart Live. Hey, if you missed the show, you can catch us on the internet at kgov.com, where we archive the programs indefinitely. That's kgov.com. And this is a live commercial break. Our phone number you can also use to reach our order desk. So when you hear the number 1-800-8-NYART, or if you jot it down, 1-800-836-9278, then as you're going on through your week, your month, if you come up with a Bible question, let's say it's about predestination and free will, or the end times, or prophecy, or somebody's sick, and what are the chances that the person could be healed? You have a question like that, you could give us a call, and we don't have a full-time staff to answer people's questions, but we have a lifetime worth of Bible resources. Albums, Bible study albums on books of the Bible. Albums on topics like predestination and free will and miracles and healing and the last days and the deity of Jesus Christ, the book of Revelation, the book of Genesis. How about Noah's flood? It's so much fun to study the Bible, the Exodus story. So you give us a call and say, what are you discussing? Divorce and remarriage. We've got a video that covers that topic very handily, and Bible study audio tapes also. Evolution, creation, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, God and the death penalty. We've got a video on New Testament support for capital punishment. So whatever it is, the issue that comes up, remember our number, call and we'll help out. Bob Benyart Live here. This is listener-supported radio in a live commercial break. And I'm encouraging you, now think through this, to memorize our 800 number, our phone number, so that as you're going through your life this week or this month or this year, if a debate comes up or a question comes up about, say, drug use in the Bible or alcohol, whatever the topic, let's say it's criminal justice and what's right, what's wrong regarding criminal justice. Should we be putting people in jails? Should they be executed? Well, remember our number, call us, and whatever the question, we should be able to help with our materials, 800-8-NYARD. That's 1-800-836-9278. Now, if you go to the web online, the best Christian site in the world, theologyonline.com, with over 1 million posts, not visits, not hits, but posts. And here we are. There's a battle royale number 7. Theology Online, where I get to debate an atheist whose screen name on the internet is Zakath. And he posted his first post. It's 10 rounds. And he asked, how do you define God and what evidence do you base your belief in this God upon? And so this is my post, my first post, replying to him. So round one is done. The first ply is done. And I pointed out that I'm presenting evidence in this post related to God being the creator, eternal, powerful, knowledgeable. And I'm taking evidence from the origins of both the universe and biological life. Now, in future posts, I expect to use more evidence from physics and biology and add evidence from astronomy, and then as evidence for God being personal, loving, and just, I will present observations from psychology, which is just the study of human beings, and history. History is the study of pretty much everything that's happened on Earth. Okay, so, Zakath, thank you for clearly delineating your questions. I have summarized my 4 questions for you at the end. Perhaps we could agree to give clear and concise answers to each other's questions at the top of our subsequent posts, as I have attempted here, and then develop the answers if desired. Okay, then there's a heading titled Potential Cost of Atheism Priced by the Nature of God. In other words, what is the cost of atheism? If you're an atheist and you're wrong, there is a God, what's the difference? What's the cost of being an atheist? Well, it depends on the nature of God. It depends on the nature of God. If God is as the Bible says he is, then the cost of being an atheist is huge. If God is as a deist, like Thomas Jefferson thought him to be, then the cost of being an atheist is less significant. But here, let's get to the post. Yes, if atheism is true, there is a great waste in theism, in belief in God. But on the other hand, if God exists, then atheists have expended an opportunity cost. In other words, there's a price to be paid for having been an atheist, if there is a God, the value of which depends upon God's nature and actions, upon what God is like. And this brings us to the to further develop your first question about the definition of God. If someone proposed a God created by some other God, then they proposed wrongly and may have been referring to an angel or a demon or some other created being, but not to God. So for the sake of understanding, let us agree that the God we are debating, the one I argue for and you against, is the first creator, the eternally existing, uncaused, first cause. Regarding the potential opportunity cost of not believing in him, and then there are four bullets, four different degrees, four different prices of being an atheist. And I give examples. For example, if God created matter, and that's all he did, he created matter and then left everything to itself to develop based on physical laws and chance. And that God, he has, if he has no interest in the behavior of any life forms that may develop, if that's the kind of God that there is, then the cost of being an atheist would be relatively low, limited to the scientific drawbacks that may come from an incorrect view of the origin of matter. But what if the God of the universe, what if he designed the universe? He didn't just make matter, but he designed the universe, and he designed biological life and sentient life, but he has no righteous standard and no aspirations for his creatures. Then the atheistic opportunity cost would be higher, retarding the progress of science through a misunderstanding of the origins of inanimate and biological systems. However, here's the third point, the third way of pricing the cost of being an atheist. If God created the universe and life and instilled humans with a conscience which reflects his own righteous standard, then the atheistic cost becomes increasingly significant in scientific, moral, and psychological terms. And if the true God also is as the Bible presents, and he has put eternity into our hearts and will judge us based upon our humble trusting in him, then you calculate the atheistic cost in terms of eternal loss of the utmost consequence. Thus, my second question to you, Zakath, is, does absolute moral right and wrong exist? For example, is it absolutely wrong to drag a living black man behind a pickup truck to tear apart his body out of white supremacist motives? Is that absolutely wrong? If you answer no, and that there is no such thing as absolute morality, then I will despise your character and record more evidence that atheism undermines morality. But I will continue the debate, realizing that you would not believe it wrong for you to lie in an effort to win this battle royale. Right? If he doesn't believe in right and wrong, and he's trying to win the battle, then he would not believe it wrong to lie in the debate. If you don't believe in right and wrong, that's why so many people approve of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is a lying fornicator. And you don't have to think too hard to figure out that lying fornicators might like him because they make him feel good. And if you're inclined toward sexual immorality or lying or stealing, you might be inclined to say, you know, there's no such thing as right or wrong, and I could do anything that I think that feels good, anything I approve of, that's what I can do, and there's no consequence. Certainly no eternal consequence. On the other hand, continuing with this, does absolute moral right and wrong exist? On the other hand, what if you admit that there is an absolute right and wrong? For example, that it is inherently right to stop an adult from forcibly raping a child for entertainment. If you admit to right and wrong, then you will have provided evidence for the definition of the real God. And you will also have helped us calculate the opportunity cost of atheism. For if there is an absolute originator, a creator, then logically an absolute moral standard would have originated with him. So you get it? If he says there's no such thing as right and wrong, that's what most atheists would say, no absolute moral right and wrong, then the problem is he would not believe it wrong to lie, and it affects your character if you don't believe in right and wrong, and you undermine morality. And that's what your atheism, that's what atheism has pushed many people toward. On the other hand, if you admit that there is an absolute right and wrong, then you've told us something about this God that we're debating. Because if there is an absolute standard of right and wrong, regardless of what anyone or everyone thinks, then that standard transcends humanity, and it is only reasonable to conclude that an absolute standard of morality would come from the absolute creator, the originator. And so depending on how he answers that question, he shows us either way the cost of atheism. It'd be interesting. All right. And then we get to the next heading, which is evidence for God from physics. And this is fun. Evidence for God from physics. This has to do with God being powerful and being the creator and being eternal. For now, let's move from the potential consequences of atheism on to develop my answer to your second question for evidence for God. Evidence that I will draw from different spheres of study, beginning with physics and biology. If the flow of the debate facilitates, I will also add evidence from astronomy, psychology, and history. So my first evidence from physics: a rock cannot make itself from nothing, and a fire cannot burn forever. You should recognize these as alternative ways of stating the first two laws of thermodynamics. Right? Have you heard this? A rock cannot make itself from nothing, and a fire cannot burn forever. These two laws, they're the laws of the conservation of matter and energy and the law of the increase in entropy, that a rock cannot make itself from nothing and a fire cannot burn forever. So that leads us to my third question for Zakath, which is, it's a multiple choice. A, do you believe the natural universe has existed forever, exerting work and burning as a perpetual motion machine? Or B, has the universe created itself, so to speak, that has come into existence apart from a supernatural creator? Or C, was it created by an external source outside of the natural universe that is a supernatural creator? Or D, is there some other conceivable account for its origins? And if he says D, I'm going to press him on that, because I don't think there's any logical possibility for a fourth way for the universe to come into existence. So we'll continue that after this. One 800 8 NYARD. That's 1-800-836-9278. I'm suggesting, this is a live commercial break, listener-supported radio, and I'm suggesting you memorize our phone number in case during the week you come up with a Bible question. Like, let's say a Christian says to you, hey, we should only eat food based on the Mosaic dietary law, and you've been eating pepperoni pizzas, And pork, of course, is not allowed by the Mosaic dietary law. So then you have to process that. And you have to think through it. And if you are a Christian and you honor God and you respect his word, you have to think, okay, yes or no, or do I or don't I? And so you can call us at 800-8-NYART, and we'll refer you to, well, the plot manuscript, and you find out. Now, listener-supported radio, Bob Enyart Live, and this is a live commercial break. And I've taken to encouraging people to memorize our call-in line because it's also our order line. And if you, as you're going on in your Christian life, if you end up with a question during the week, and let's say we just talked about the question being, well, what if another Christian says, hey, you have to eat food based on the Mosaic dietary law. You cannot eat lobster, shrimp, or pork, green chili. Certain things you just can't eat because God said in the Bible to Israel, you can't eat those things. And so now how do you respond? And further, they might show you a Bible verse and say, look, if you disobey God's laws, you'll be diseased. You'll have diseases. But if you obey him, you'll be healthy. And so then you have to figure out, okay, does God want me to obey the Mosaic dietary law that the Lord gave to Israel? Or do I not have to obey it for some reason? Because Christians take both sides of that issue. And you could study it, and I encourage you to do that. Take out your Bible, read everything the Bible says on that topic. But I can promise you it may be confusing because the Bible appears to say two things on that topic. It appears to say at times that you could eat anything, like God said to Noah, you can eat anything. After he got off the ark, all meat, all animals you can eat. Or can you not? one 800 836 9278. Hey, you know what? Since that was a live commercial break and this is a live show, I could finish the point there. That the Bible seems to say you can eat any meat you want to eat, like God said to Noah and Paul seemed to say, or you can only eat certain clean foods, as God said to Moses. And which is it? Well, there are thousands of verses that appear to contradict in the Bible, and that's one reason so many Christians get discouraged trying to understand it. And the thing to do is start out with an overview of the whole Bible. And that's why we put together the plot manuscript. We have it on audio tape, on MP3, CD-ROM, and in print, in an unpublished manuscript, which we've sold 60,000 copies of Bible study tapes and videos and manuscripts, all based on studying the Bible and from that overview of the Bible on down. Okay, so you just heard my third question to Zakath on the debate going on theologyonline.com, Does God Exist? The Battle Royale 7. And so I asked this multiple choice question, and then I follow the question with this, saying to Zakath, if you choose perpetual motion machine, you know, that the universe, the sun, the stars are burning, the universe is alive with work, with motion, and with heat. Things are burning, transfers of energy. And so if the universe was always here and always moving and working and burning and churning, then it's effectively a perpetual motion machine. But scientists have told us there's no such thing as a perpetual motion machine in a closed system. And the universe is a closed system because the universe is everything, all physical matter that exists. So if you choose that the universe is a perpetual motion machine, or if you choose that the universe just came into being by itself out of nothing, I will press you on the laws of physics and on your evidence for your conclusion. and I will explore whether you believe this based upon a blind faith, which runs contrary to hard science. And if you choose other, please explain what other possible way the universe could have come into existence, as I do not believe you can logically present a fourth option. For the natural universe was either one, always here, or two, popped into existence from nothing on its own apart from any creator, or three, was brought into existence by a supernatural creator, meaning the natural universe was created by something outside of itself, so by a supernatural creator, that is, one outside of the natural universe. Okay, so that's my evidence for God from physics. Now, evidence for God from biology. And this is, if you could get your mind around this, you're good. Because God is complex. And he made life, and biological life is complex. And so I'm making an argument from the complexity of biological life and the origin of life. And so by its very nature, the argument is somewhat complex, because the complexity is the proof. It's the evidence. So let's look at it. Evidence for God from biology. My second and for now last piece of evidence for God is from the argument from design for biological life. Now, some of you know what the argument from design is, and it's this. Evidence for God comes from when you see design, then you can logically deduce that there must be a designer. For example, atheists, many, maybe most, believe that there's alien life. Right? Most atheists, they reject the evidence for Jesus Christ, but they believe in aliens. Okay. And we spend millions of dollars listening to radio waves coming from outer space, hoping to find evidence for life, for intelligent life in the universe somewhere, in the galaxy. And so they're listening for patterns, like, for example, prime numbers they're listening for, or maybe squares. Like if you got a radio signal and in it was pulses that counted out 1, 2, 4, 9, 16, 25, 36, 49, then somebody would say, oh, those are squares. They're squares and or prime numbers. Look, they're a list of prime numbers. There must be intelligent life out there. So the same atheists that deny the complexity of DNA as evidence for a creator, a designer, would insist that we spend $1 billion looking for aliens if we got five prime numbers come in a radio wave. What's more complex, DNA or five prime numbers in a radio wave? There's no comparison. So the hypocrisy is just, it's paramount. The hypocrisy. They could tell what evidence from design is. They know it in their gut, but they deny it because they don't want to believe in God. So my second piece of evidence for God is from the argument from design for biological life. Atheists believe that if just the right raw materials were assembled. Now, tell me if this is true or not. Atheists believe that if just the right raw materials were assembled, then it is reasonable to believe that life could arise spontaneously. Don't they believe that? If everything was just right, then life could happen by itself. However, dead animal carcasses, think of a dead rabbit in a field. Dead animal carcasses have trillions of compounds already assembled in just the right proportions for life. And yet scientists have never observed new life arising from the fortuitously arranged ingredients in every corpse. Why isn't life popping out of every corpse if you need just the right elements assembled? Well, there they are. Just put a dead cat in a blender and see how many lives pop out of it. Should be popping out life right and left. There's a trillion opportunities there. Around the world with all the dead carcasses, how many opportunities are there? Quintillions of opportunities every second for life to pop out. Everything is right there. The primordial soup, forget it. You got life. There it is. Let's have some life. But it doesn't come. It doesn't come. Because, and that's evidence, that is evidence that their hope is a false hope. See, the Bible says faith is the evidence of things not seen. So if we took dead bodies and watched them for centuries, which we've done in science, and if we see life just sprouting out of them, new kinds of life, then we would say, hey, you know, if you have just the right raw materials assembled, then it's reasonable to believe that life could spring from it, because it does. But it doesn't. So faith is the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things hoped for. But if you don't have any evidence, then it's not faith. It's blind faith. Let me continue. Co-discoverer of DNA, Crick, Francis Crick, and brilliant astronomer Hoyle both conceded that the complexity of DNA led them to conclude the mathematical implausibility that DNA could have arisen by natural causes on Earth. And so they independently proposed to the world, these two brilliant scientists, one a Nobel Prize winner, they independently proposed to the world that biological life was planted on Earth by aliens. These two are the most brilliant scientists of this past century. A cell, a living cell, makes man's technology look primitive, with hundreds of millions of its simplest components, the proteins, albeit themselves sophisticated three-dimensional machines of thousands of different types, doing a multitude of critical chemical jobs, coordinated by hundreds of millions of digital instructions, with a human possessing dozens of different types of cells, totaling about 100 trillion cells in a human body. 100 trillion. Living cells are the laboratories that make an organism's chemical components, yet they themselves are made of these same components. And that's a dilemma for the atheist. We'll get to it after this. Listener-supported radio right here, 1-800-8-NYART, 1-800-836-9278. Now, if you memorize that number, you know, 800-8-NYART, well, you have to know how to spell NYART. That's E-N-Y-A-R-T. E-N-Y-A-R-T, NYART. I remember on KOA Radio, George Weber in Denver. He's a popular nighttime host years ago. He was on for a long time, and he was doing a promo for his show, and he said, this George Weber, Weber, he said, I'm having a hard time saying my name. Sometimes I just can't quite get it out. Weber, there it is, Weber. He said, please tune into my show. I got a kick out of that. Anyway, Bob Enyart, E-N-Y-A-R-T, so 1-800-8 E-N-Y-A-R-T. And if you remember that number, then during the week, if a Bible question comes up, let's say it's about evolution and creation. Now, we don't have a full-time staff here to answer calls live, but we have so many resources about the Bible. And if you've got a question, if you're in a debate with an atheist, or let's say an evolutionist, we might suggest that you listen to the Genesis Creation album, 6 tapes on Genesis chapters 1 and 2. Let's say you're thinking about Adam and Eve in the fall, and why did God put the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the middle of the garden? Why did he do that? Why did he make it so easy for Adam and Eve to rebel and for sin to come into the world? And why was Lucifer there in the garden? And how long did Adam and Eve live before they fell, before they sinned? Was it centuries, decades, years, months, weeks, days? How long was it? Well, if you call up with any question like that, we'd say, well, we have an album called Genesis the Fall, and it is so much fun, and it will blow your mind listening to it. And when you're done, you'll be dancing on your kitchen table. Well, you might not do that. But you'll be so excited because you'll think, wow, the Bible makes so much sense and there's so much there. And that's why the Bible says that God has appointed teachers, people who spend their lives studying the Word and then teaching. So give us a call. one 800 8 N Yards, 1-800-836-9278. So there's a problem. We're to the last argument in the post. And then after that, I have a summary of the 4 questions for Zaketh. But we're getting to the part about all the circular dependency in biological life. And there's circularly dependent requirements that the living cell is the laboratory that makes the components needed for the cell to survive. So how did it get going? You can't have a cell unless you have a huge supply of these crucial and wildly complex components. Yet how could the components be made without the cell? So I point out that living cells are the laboratories that make an organism's chemical components, yet they themselves are made of these same components. Such circularly dependent requirements pervade biology and introduce a dilemma for atheists, for no plausible starting point has ever been described for this circular dependence. So this remains an inexplicable mystery to evolutionists, which they typically ignore and have never come close to answering. By natural law, you cannot get a tree without a seed, nor an egg without a chicken, nor the system to copy DNA without the DNA itself. How are you going to copy the DNA? You got to do that when the cell divides. And every time, let's say you want to make a protein. How many different kinds of proteins are there? Thousands. And they're pretty complex, three-dimensional machines that do chemical jobs. So you got to make a protein. How do you know the instructions how to make it? Well, it's somewhere in the DNA. And the nucleus has to expose of 3 billion base pairs of amino acids in the human DNA that the information for that protein, maybe it's a few hundred steps, rungs on the ladder, a few hundred pairs of amino acids describing this is how you make a protein. Well, if we have 3 billion rungs of information in our DNA and there's just 300 to describe this one protein, let's say 1,000, well, where is it among those 3 billion? Well, maybe it's 2/3 of the way through. How do you get 2/3 of the way through 3 billion to find just a few thousand instructions? Well, the nucleus unravels this huge molecule, this DNA molecule, and gets it to right just the right spot. because someone requested of the nucleus that they have that instruction set to make that particular protein. And so the nucleus unravels the DNA, but it doesn't get it all knotted up. It does it very orderly, and it finds the right spot, and it exposes it, and then copies are made. And copies are made of just that chunk, and then those copies are used, and somebody follows the instructions, and the protein is assembled. That's slick. That's really slick. And so what came first, the DNA or the system to copy the DNA? Now back to the post. Evolutionists cannot explain, even theoretically, in gross terms, how the first DNA strand appeared. And then before the how did the first strands appear? And then before they deteriorated, how an error-correcting duplication system arose by chance. To manage life's nutritional and functional needs, a typical cell needs to separate itself from its outside environment. It needs sophisticated subsystems with high bandwidth and robust communication between them. It must be able to produce hundreds of intricate compounds. It must repair damaged components. It must selectively admit raw materials from outside and expel waste. And paramount, it must reliably reproduce itself. Evolutionists admit great complexity in obtaining a first cell by nature. They admit that. They admit that to get the first cell is a very complex process. But they don't appreciate how many first cells would you need? How many first cells would have disappeared before perfecting the ability to reproduce themselves? Millions? Billions? Trillions? Supposedly blindly moving toward an unknowable goal of self-reproduction without benefit of natural selection nor any law or force driving them forward to achieve that particular goal. So you've got some proteins, enzymes, and they're going to figure out, well, we have to reproduce ourselves. They don't know that. There's no law that forces them toward reproduction. There's no force. There's not even natural selection. For natural selection, you need trillions of cells functioning in millions of organisms that are already developed. Thus, apart from any evidence, atheists desperately posit some simpler form of life that led up to the cell. But that is a logical impossibility given the function of biological life. A toddler gets away with his ignorance, explaining that bread comes from the store. But I will not accept an adult's rationalization of complexity by his introducing even more complexity. To identify, now try to follow this one sentence. Think about a single-celled creature. If you're going to identify only the necessary systems in a single-celled creature, that means you're going to identify virtually the entire cell because they're all needed, all its systems. And so its subsystems cannot be removed without certain death. You got a single-celled creature, and you're going to take away its ability to process, say, glucose or something to make energy. You take away that system, and it's going to die. Unless somehow, and this is what atheists try to come up with, unless somehow a single cell wasn't able to do all its functions, but there was some other life form outside of it that provided those same services. But, of course, if that were how life first started, you had different life forms that were all helping one another symbiotically, that makes it more complex, not less. Because then you have multiple different life forms, and they have to communicate, external communication, coordination, shared ecosystem dependency. It gets more complicated, not less. So I declare that the atheist who posits a simpler life form, which leads up to the cell, cannot even conceptually describe that simplicity. Thus, he posits something that he has no evidence for and something that he cannot even imagine. That is blind faith. Zaketh, perhaps you can disprove my declaration and explain what basic functions a cell's simpler precursors would perform and how they might perform them reliably and more simply. Let me remind you, Zaketh, of a cell's basic functions that must somehow be addressed for survival. First, please explain what comes first, the functionality or the instructions to build the functionality. Then, describe what force or law led to the development of an instruction set for that functionality, and how those instructions then began to encode themselves chemically with amino acids. Then explain how those encoded instructions began to get implemented by describing some primitive ribosome-like agents and how the theoretically necessary function of messenger RNA would have been accomplished with the development of proteins and enzymes, or their simpler predecessors, to accomplish the needed work of maintenance and reproduction. Also, Zaketh, you might explain, and win a Nobel Prize while you're at it, how the wildly complex and crucial cell wall with a million sophisticated openings could develop. The wall needed for the survival of the cell, yet utterly dependent upon the cell's functions for its own existence. Instructions for all of this are encoded into the DNA in the nucleus. The nucleus itself, housing these millions of instructions and being able to produce groups of them on demand as needed to build complex chemical machines, all dependent upon the availability of a necessary supply of various amino acids. Of course, I'm not asking you for a detailed account of how this all would happen in a simpler life form. But Zaketh, for my fourth question, A, can you please either explain conceptually how the first cell would have developed, or B, give an explanation in broad terms of how a simpler system could perform the necessary functions of a biological life form, which I believe must include processing raw materials, containing itself, encoding instructions, implementing instructions, chemical processing, and reproduction, which whole system is itself irreducibly complex. And then I summarize my four questions for Zaketh. Does truth exist? Yes, no, I don't know. Does absolute moral right and wrong exist? Yes, no, I don't know. Regarding the origin of the natural universe, was it always here? Did it pop into existence from nothing? Was it created or other? If other, please explain. And Zaketh, hey, then you get to attempt to conceptually explain, apart from a creator, how the first cell developed. Or maybe the functional simplicity of pre-cell life forms. Or if you choose C, you could explain nothing substantive about life's origin based on your worldview. So it'll be interesting to see how Zaketh responds. You're going to want to check it out for yourself on TheologyOnline.com. TheologyOnline.com. Look for the Battle Royale. This is Bob Benyart reminding you to do right and risk the consequences.